This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome.
Want to know one of my biggest frustrations with EdTech? Having too many tools and not enough time to use them right. They require too much training and it takes too much effort to implement it effectively. That's why it makes such a difference that IXL can do the job of dozens of individual tools, so that I have everything I need for instruction and assessment in one place. IXL is research proven to accelerate achievement. Studies across 45 states show that IXL schools outperform non-IXL schools on state assessments, and independent research from Johns Hopkins University verifies that IXL meets ESSA Tier 1 standards. With those results combined with IXL's teacher-friendly reputation, what more could you ask for? I'm sure you want to increase achievement for all students. Find out how IXL can help. Visit IXL.com/BE for a demo. That's IXL.com/BE.
To the Cyber Traps podcast, my name is Frederick Lane, and I'm coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. I am an author, attorney, and educational consultant based in the city. I'm the author of 10 books, including most recently Cyber Traps for Educators 2.0, Raising Cyber Ethical Kids, and Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. My co-host Jethro Jones and I have teamed up to bring timely, entertaining, and useful information to teachers, parents, and others about the risks arising from the use and misuse of digital devices. I'm working solo today, so I'll take over Jethro's pitch, which is to say that over the coming weeks and months, we'll be talking to some of the world's leading experts from the fields of education, parenting, sociology, and cyber safety. Join us as we look at what it takes to better navigate our increasingly high-tech world. For more information or to donate to our work, please visit centerforcyberethics.org. The Cyber Traps podcast is a production of the Center for Cyber Ethics, a 501c3 independent nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to the study and promotion of cyber ethics as a positive social force through research, curricular development, publishing and media, professional training, and public advocacy. And with the preliminaries out of the way, I would like to welcome today's guest, law professor Amos Giora, who is going to be talking to us about his work and his recent publication, Armies of Enablers. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. 2 points for getting the last name correct.
Well, I did take a little coaching, to be perfectly honest, for the audience. So, sir, Please give us a little bit of introduction to your work and the kinds of issues you're interested in, and then we'll dive in.
Excellent. So give me exactly 3 minutes, and so to keep it crisp so the audience will stick with me. 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Crime of Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust, which is about my parents who are both deceased but are Holocaust survivors. And I explored their god-awful stories through the lens of the person who was present, the bystander. And that led to the book, which you graciously referenced, Armies of Enablers, in which I interviewed the sexual assault survivors from Michigan State, USA Gymnastics, Ohio State Catholic Church. I tried to get to the boys who were raped at Penn State by Sandusky, couldn't get to them, but I wrote about them. That book came out, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And that book has then led to this new project, which is audience forewarned, is a terrible project called it The Ecosystem of Pedophilia. Mm-hmm. It's looking at the role of the enabler in pedophilia. The project revolves around the 1997 murder of a 12-year-old boy, Jeremy Bell, who was murdered by his teacher, Principal Edgar Friedrichs in West Virginia. The teacher, Principal Friedrichs, had been shuffled from school to school in Pennsylvania and in West Virginia. when he murders the boy on November 7th, 1997, he never should have ever had access to that little boy. His career should have come to a crashing end decades before. Not only did school administrators shuffle him from school to school, but the night of the murder, local law enforcement, they rushed to close the case. There is a terrible report by a medical examiner ruling that the boy died tragically of asphyxiation. In real life, as we came to learn, thanks to the extraordinary efforts of a remarkable private investigator, Dan Barber, the boy was murdered. Ultimately, Frutix was prosecuted, convicted, incarcerated. He will die in jail. But what's important for me in the context of this project, and one more word about that, is examining the role of the enabler. And it's the reason that the University of Utah Law School has now established a bystander initiative, working on using the Jeremy Bell case as the platform for an article, a book, interactions like this, working on legislation both in the United States and internationally to address not the perpetrator, not the pedophile, but the enablers. And the other piece of that is engage in a project with a professor of public health, trying to analyze different variables in different communities, the ecological factors that perhaps play a role in pedophilia. Studies of this has not been done before in this whole project. The polite word is it's difficult, it's brutal. I have students who are working with me, and the biggest shout out goes to them because the material is difficult and they're willing to work with me on it. I also teach a class at the University of Utah Honors College on this, teach a course at the law school on this. This is what I do.
It's vitally needed work. I don't know if we've had a chance to discuss this. And actually, just as a bit of context for the audience, you and I had a chance to meet for the first time at the Professional Practices Institute in October, which was the source of a number of our other podcast episodes. And you gave a presentation on this very topic, which is what inspired me to invite you onto the podcast. I don't know if we discussed the fact that for the last 20 years, I've done computer forensics in this general area. And it is brutal stuff. And I think that there's so many different aspects of it that we could touch on. But for the purposes of this particular podcast, we tend to focus on the educational environment and the role that technology is playing in that environment and some of the risks that arise. So let's go back first to your book, where you're talking about the army of enablers. And we will
armies,
right? Multiple armies. We will put a link to that in the show notes. So that
people... I'll also ask you to put a link to the bystander initiative.
Oh, we absolutely will. Anything of that sort that you want us to put in there. So with the armies of enablers, it seems to me that that was your first opportunity to get some insight into the role that institutions can play in facilitating the bystanding, if you will. So would you like to comment on that?
Because 100% I think it's correct. Because as the older of the two of us here, life is too short to not be blunt and honest. I had never heard the word bystander before. I'd never heard the word enabler before until beginning this project. So with respect to armies of enablers, I was speaking to a woman who's in the book. She's Jane Doe. And I kept talking about Nassar bystander. And she said to me, you know, like, Lord, how stupid are you? I said, okay, why this time? She said, with Nassar, there were no bystanders. They were enablers. Meaning the institutional actors who knew but failed to act in order to protect. They protected the institution rather than protecting the individual. I've never heard that word before. And I went to the class, the honors college class, and I said to the class, I said, listen, I have no idea what this word means, enablers, but I'm going to write a book about it. They all looked at me like, what are you talking about? I said, I don't know, but that's what this led to. And then I started interviewing the girls, and her name is Lindsay Lemke. She was the captain of Michigan State's gymnastics team. And I was talking about army of enablers, like you, army. She also said to me, Giora, like, how stupid are you? I said, yes, two in a row. I said, why this time? She said, because it wasn't an army, it was armies. She said, wherever we turned, we were confronted by, she was the captain of the gymnastics team. So when she went to complain against Nassar, the head gymnastics coach, a woman named Kathy Klagas, protected Nassar and Michigan State in the name of institutional complicity. And all the girls who I interviewed, wherever they turned, this way, they ran up against a huge wall who had one purpose, and that was to protect directly the institution and indirectly the perpetrator. And that's what institutional complicity is.
So the desire to protect the institution ends up exacerbating the whole situation, because it's the perpetrator, and protecting that individual is basically seen as a cost of protecting the institution.
It's very interesting you put it that way. And I use the word girls deliberately because that's how they request to be referred to, because they were girls when it happened. So it's not women, but girls. Their anger today is not at all at Larry Nassar. I mean, listen, he did what he did. This is the way they talk.
Yeah.
Their rage is at the enablers, the coaches at Michigan State, or at the USA Gymnastics for the girls in the Olympics, because the enablers protected the institution and the individual and absolutely guaranteed the exacerbation of the harm. And the numbers are astounding.
They're staggering numbers.
That's right. Maddie Larson, who at one time was voted America's favorite gymnast, she was sexually violated by Larry Nassar 750 times. Tiffany Thomas Lopez was violated 150 times. And
it's hard to wrap your head around
100%. And they know that. They understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers, it's unfathomable, actually.
That's really crazy. So I think that that's a really important insight, both for us as individuals to understand what these girls slash young women are saying about who they're angry at. Mm. And I think that's a great thing for administrators listening to this podcast to contemplate, because you can't necessarily prevent evil actions by an individual. You know, you hopefully try to, but sometimes they do what they do, as the young woman put it. But these individuals and these institutions that have an overarching duty of protection for the children, that I could see being truly infuriating if that is put aside because they're worried about donors or the reputation of the gymnastics program or what have you.
You and I are of age. I mean, you've held a newspaper in your life, right? I
assume I've written for newspapers.
Some of your audience would know a newspaper if it hit them in the head, but there's that expression above the fold.
Yes.
And that's right. And for institutions, they lose sleep at night about the above the fold. You know, think about Penn State and Jerry Sandusky.
Of course.
If you think about the Catholic Church, we go on and on and on. Or my peeps in Israel with the rabbis, we go on and on and on. The fear is above the fold, about in terms of negative publicity. In the name of negative publicity, that's a consideration. I don't know if it's the, but it's certainly an important one. Mm-hmm. You, the institutional enabler, will protect the institution regardless of the duty you owe to the individual.
Mm. Now, there's some segues here to the project that you're doing with respect to the ecosystem of pedophilia. But before we move on to that, I'm curious to get your thoughts. You've studied this, you've talked to victims, you've really done a deep dive into these kinds of situations. What is your advice for an institution or a specific administrator to overcome what I would call the institutional fetal position, is the way I would put it? They curl up and they don't want to look at what's happening. So if you're a person of conscience in an organization or institution like that, what do you do? What's your recourse?
Of course, I like the fetal position metaphor.
Thank you.
First of all, institutional actors have to be held accountable, and it's okay for people to be fired. It's fine. Whether it's university presidents, whether it's CEOs, accountability is important. I work with legislators to change criminal codes to make this a crime. And a gymnastics coach like Kathy Klages at Michigan State, who told Lemke three magical sentences. She said to Lemke, if she complained about Nassar, one, I'll have to talk to your parents. Incorrect. Lemke was a 21-year-old adult. I don't talk to your parents. Two, she says to her, I want you to think about how this will impact Larry and his family. That's not Lindsay Lemke's concern at all. And three, she told Lemke, I remind you, she said, scholarships are given, scholarships are taken. That's a threat. Mm-hmm. That's a direct threat. There's no subtlety in that. I mean, that's cash money. These scholarships are worth a lot of money. Kathy Klages ended up in jail anyway, but for something else, I would make that a crime.
Well, it is a form of extortion.
It is. I mean,
yes.
I mean, you and I both know that college scholarships are worth a lot of money.
Tell me about it.
No, right? And if I tell you, here it is, but whoop, I'm taking it back.
Or it's not guaranteed. It's contingent on
exactly on you playing ball with us. I think that holding these people to the fire, metaphorically, is absolutely essential. And I will also tell you this, is Maddie Larson said to me once, every time USA Gymnastics would come out with a press statement, there's nothing more important than your health, welfare, all that stuff. Maddie would say, I can't stand those press releases. Because
it makes her sick to her stomach, yeah.
Totally. Because there's no substance to it whatsoever. And the lack of accountability beyond your health, welfare, those lines, or our thoughts and prayers, all those are nothing but mantras that are devoid of meaning and have no substance whatsoever. So to your question, twofold approach. One is to fire people, goodbye, thank you very much, or without thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And two, to hold them criminally accountable. By the way, if you fire them without the golden, what do you call it? The golden handshake?
Golden parachute, money, whatever. Yeah.
Whatever it's called. Absolutely. No way.
It's all gold at the end of the day.
by the way, whether it's $1 or $1 million, hang on. From the perspective of the survivor, I don't know if you saw this, but I think 2 weeks ago, Michigan State University did an unveiling of the portrait of the resigned, fired, dismissed, whichever adjective you want, former president of Michigan State University, Lou Anna Simon, who was a major enabler, drove the girls crazy. Because they said, wait a minute, Larry Nassar happens under her watch. She is the president of Michigan State University. And you can actually see on YouTube, I'll send it to you, when Lemke confronts her at Lemke's victim impact statement in the courtroom in Lansing, Michigan, she confronts Lou Anna Simon. And it's a very, very, very powerful moment. The girls can't wrap their mind around the fact that she got an unveiling of her portrait.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. That's hard. The concept of equity and justice obviously goes so far beyond just righting the wrong. There's these additional ripple effects, I think, that we do need to look at.
I agree with that 100%.
Interesting. Well, let's use that as a segue to your current project, because in many ways, that's even more relevant to the K-12 officials in our audience. And I'd love to have you talk a little bit more broadly about what you're hoping to accomplish with the program, how it's structured, and then we'll get into some of the systemic issues, which bear some resemblance to what was going on with Armies of Enablers.
So first and foremost, whether it's the project with the professor of public health or the bystander initiative at the law school, I would suggest there are three goals. One, albeit I have no hair, I wear three hats in the conversation.
May need them more for
exactly. One is to educate. At the end of the day, that's what I do, right? I'm an educator. And same. The idea is to educate, whether it's through law review articles or books or conversations like this. Two is to absolutely be, whatever this phrase means, engage within the public discussion, whatever that word means. And I think that's really, really, really important. And that's why I welcome gracious invitations such as yours. And the third is to work with directly, indirectly, I don't care, with those who are boots on the ground. I'll give you an example. We're in January. I think it's either next month or in March. Don't remember. I apologize. I'm giving two talks here in Salt Lake City, one talk to seventh graders on this, 300 seventh graders. And then I'm giving a talk to 11th and 12th graders. I've done this before. I've spoken with teachers. I think it's really important to be honest. I mean, there's different ways you speak to different audiences, of course, but to be able to have an honest conversation about the role, not of the perpetrator, but of the role of those and the obligation of those who know that something wrong is happening. And obviously, you speak to seventh graders differently than you speak to 12th graders, and you speak to 12th graders differently than how you speak to law students.
I truly get that. One of the funnier experiences in my speaking career was doing a full day at a school, and they wanted me to talk about internet safety to kindergarten and first grade students. And that was a surprisingly heavy lift, I have to tell you.
That would be challenging because, first of all, I assume first graders today know a lot more than you and I did when we were in first grade.
In some ways, yes.
But they're still in first grade.
They're still in first grade. And actually, to be honest with you, some of their socialization lags behind probably what you and I had, because we were forced to interact with our peers.
That's a great point, because of COVID. Yeah.
COVID, but also devices. And, you know, I was climbing trees and playing kickball and all of that stuff. That's, and I don't want to make it idyllic, because in information smarts, these kids are amazing. Like, I was playing a geography game with my niece the other night at dinner. She blew me out of the water. because she's doing these apps that, you know, you guess different countries.
And,
I was just so impressed. Like, I couldn't have done that in middle school if you put a gun to my head. And so there's these trade-offs, right? But the audience-specific thing that you're getting at, I think, is really important. And for you to go from seventh grade to 1L or 2L, that's a not insignificant jump.
It's a good thing I worked out this morning so I can jump.
I haven't done my run yet.
Listen, it's simple for me to your question.
Yeah.
I don't know if this will make sense to you, but it's part of it. I think this is the best answer I can give you. After the book Crime of Complicity came out, it's been translated into Dutch and Chinese, and I've given talks around the world, blah, blah, blah. I'm well aware of the fact that there's criticism of me in the American Jewish community, in some sectors of the American Jewish community. And the criticism of me in the American Jewish community is that, not my word, but this is what was written, is I'm using my parents' Holocaust story to tell a story about contemporary society. And using was viewed as a negative. I went to my mom was then obviously alive, she's not deceased. And I went to her and I said, you know, if inadvertently, God forbid, I am offending you by telling your story to try to institute change in today's society, then I will stop, full on. I will stop immediately. Because the last thing you want to do is irritate your 85-year-old mother. I mean, none of us have the courage to do that. And my mom, who was 5'2", 97 pounds, said to me the following. She said, you keep on using our story. If our terrible story, and their story was horrible, if our terrible story can be used as an engine for change, you keep on going. And that's what drives us.
Sure.
So in many ways, it is for me honoring their legacy. That's what ties all this together. And even the project with the match, if you will, between law and public health is taking a significant number of data points, criteria, where they're specific to communities, and tying that, merging that into, for instance, prosecutions in various courts where there's maltreatment, mistreatment of children. I don't know if predict, maybe it's too strong of a word, but try to assess what are the factors that potentially lead to pedophilia. Full stop. There are those who will tell you pedophiles are born with it. There's nothing you can do about it. Maybe yes, maybe no, don't know. But I think by trying to undertake this very broad ecological undertaking with a significant number of data points, it's just a different way of looking at it. And I would think, given the prevalence of the problem, any research that can provide assistance to how to combat it is something that would be embraced with open arms.
Well, you would think, right? I mean, that's a very optimistic point of view. But because of the difficulty of the subject matter and because of the attack on expertise, I think we've got some real issues with respect to that rosy assumption. By way of example, look at the battle that we've had to get any basic research into mass shootings and gun violence. You know, there's actually been federal prohibitions on the CDC studying that problem because people don't want to know the answer, which most other Western democracies have pretty much figured out is guns actually are the contributing factor. But you're starting to see articles, and I don't mean in any way to make light of this, I'm just frustrated by the blinders. You're starting to see articles that explore the multivariant inputs to these kinds of attacks. And I think what you're doing with respect to pedophilia is along the same lines. We need to understand holistically what is contributing to this problem.
I think that holistic is an interesting way of looking at it. I think that is critical given the fact that it's there.
And it happens. It exists, right?
So absolutely. And we can either put our head in the sand or we can say, let's try to address this. And if there's anything I've learned in the, what is now 10 years that I've been working on this god-awful project, denying its reality does nothing more, and I don't mean this to sound dramatic, but does nothing more than ensure that the next Jeremy Bell is right around the corner. Principal Friedrichs, he didn't intend to kill Jeremy Bell. I mean,
we'll get into that in a second. I want to make sure we're mindful of time. But in a sense, if we ignore the need to study, an argument can be made that we're basically turning all of us into enablers for this particular problem. So it becomes a nation of enablers, honestly, Amos. And it seems to me that's the kind of thing we need to break through.
That is such an interesting way of putting it. I spend most of my days with sexual assault survivors from around the world. And what's so tragic is the stories, I could literally take out a name, put in a name, because it's the same wherever the hell they are, right? Whether they're in education, in academia, in the sports world, or wherever. And what has happened, trust me, unintended, is because of armies and then subsequent articles, is that people reach out to me, not about the perpetrator. The perpetrator doesn't interest me in the least.
Sure.
It's the enabler. It's the system. That's the issue. And that goes to your excellent question, but how do you hold these people accountable?
Right. Right. We'll have to put a pin in that because that is a big, big topic. But let's talk briefly about the specific case that gave rise to your project and talk about some of the factors in K-12, particularly in the United States, that contributed to that murder.
So Friedrichs, the teacher, started off his career in Philadelphia. When the heat got hot and there was going to be a trial, but there wasn't, he resigned, left, was given a letter of recommendation, which I have not physically, I mean, it's in my office, letter of recommendation, handwritten.
Amazing. Okay.
Amazing is the polite word. We'll have to be polite here. There are other words. When we found the letter, we were obviously not polite. We're putting it in. I'm writing a law review article, which I'm finishing tomorrow. I'm putting it in the article because I want people to understand how this works.
Which journal will it be in?
Well, you know how law review articles work. You write the article and you send it out and you hope somebody picks it up.
I see. Right. Of course. It's been a while since I submitted
one. Oh, that's how the shtick works. One hopes for the best. And then he leaves teaching for a year or so, opens up a clothing shop, conveniently located next to an elementary school. And then he goes to West Virginia, and he has three things working in his favor. And this will not to be awkward, but we're both adults here.
So is the audience mostly.
One, he was a good-looking guy. He was attractive. Never hurts. Two, he had money. Mm. And three, he came from the big city of Philadelphia to West Virginia. And he had suave. He had game. And he went from school. We've tracked it. From school to school to school to school. At every school, the rumors began, the complaints started, and every school administrator ignored it. And what they would simply do is
I'm sorry to interrupt, but is it, in your opinion, were they ignoring it for the same reasons that Michigan State and U.S. Gymnastics was? Is the same impulse, or do we have something different in K-12?
I can't prove anything to you about the why, and so I don't want to get into the why. I could give you assumptions until, you know, your hair looks like my hair.
It's getting there.
Do we have assumptions? Does Dan Barber, the private detective, the hero of the case, does he have assumptions? Absolutely. But from school to school to school, and the complaints and the complaints and the complaints and the rumors, and he was taking boys out to his cabin. He was taking boys skinny dipping. He was taking boys in his car to talk about sex, about sexual affairs.
To what extent do you look at the parents in terms of their
I knew you're going to ask me that. And here's my not convincing answer to you, I appreciate the question, for which I'm going to give you my answer, for which I have been criticized. Okay. Best defense is a good offense. Full disclosure. In all of my projects, I've made the deliberate decision not to examine the role of parents as facilitators, enablers to domestic violence, or parents here who knew, because I can show you parents who knew what was happening to their children, but did not act. And I read the criticism, right? It's always very interesting to read the criticism about yourself, about your work, and that I am.
Blast.
It is. It's fine. It's part of the gig. That I'm accused of ducking the hard question about parents. One of the parents here in the Bell murder, one of the mothers in the deposition said that she never knew. And I can show you that's just not true. And I also know why, in her specific case, why she did what she did. I can do that.
I would argue, and obviously you're the one who's done the research in this particular area. It occurs to me that we need to view families as institutions in the same way that we do schools.
I'm aware of that. I'm gonna duck. I'm not ducking. I don't duck. I'm gonna say that I leave that to others. I'm not gonna get into that one, but I understand that.
Yeah.
What makes the Bell case even more problematic is the speed with which local law enforcement closed the case.
And why? What did they do?
So he's murdered on the night between the 7th and 8th of November 1997. There's another boy in the cabin with him. We'll refer to him as MP, or at least never question him. There's an EMT guy who shows up. Nobody ever questioned him. There's the medical examiner who says asphyxiation, even though there are marks on the boy's face. The reason there were marks on the boy's face is because he was struggled with Friedrichs when he was chloroforming him. There was a fight. There's also a mark on the clavicle. And the clavicle was, Friedrich said, well, yeah, sure, because I gave him 7 hours of CPR. Nobody can do CPR for 7 hours. And law enforcement bought that. And then they bury the boy. Boom.
That's honestly bonkers. I've taken CPR
courses. That's the polite word is bonkers. Jeremy's father, the parents are divorced. Jeremy's father doesn't buy this. He reaches out to a cousin, who makes her way to Mr. Dan Barber in Erie, Pennsylvania. Mr. Barber gets in his car, goes to West Virginia, where he lives on and off for the next 2 years. And piece by piece, he puts the case together, which led to the conviction of sexual assault of, I think, three or four boys. And then when he's in jail for that, then he's tried for the murder of Jeremy Bell. Mr. Barber, a year ago, made an extraordinary decision, which is humbling, is an understatement. He bequeathed to me formally, contractually, 15,000 pages of documents that's serving as the basis for the book and the article. Mr. Barber, when he gave me the documents, his mandate to me, and I quote, was he's giving this to me in order to ensure as much as possible that what happened to that little boy will never happen again. If you come to my office, front and center in my office is a large picture of the boy. And I have Mr. Barber's words, I mean, from 3 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night in my head. The article will be dedicated to Jeremy Bell. And the hope really is that this will, the whole process, the whole project will have a practical impact, a legislative impact, an educational impact. Are there people who I would love to see prosecuted? You betcha. Because they're enabling, put Friedrichs in that cabin with that boy that night.
It's just a chain of events, right? And so a good chunk of what I see you trying to do is to either shorten or eliminate that chain in other institutions and other organizations.
Well, that's really well put. I mean, I want to emphasize, this is a team project, 7 students and another colleague of mine. This is there's a whole team here. I also want to emphasize the Dean of Students made an extraordinary decision. They have made available to all the students a psychologist counselor, whenever there's a need for it, given the difficulty of the material. And that's to their credit.
That's really impressive. Kudos to them. And I'm glad
100%.
I'm glad you offered a shout out on that. Let me give you a chance to wrap up our interview with any final thoughts. Are there timelines people should be aware of?
No, I'll tell you the one thing that, because I'm straight up and blunt. How's that? Is that acceptable to you?
It's the way we roll.
To make this huge project possible, we need resources. Flat out, I say that. And that's why I will send you the link to the Bystander Initiative. There's a what we call the donation, and I will send it to you. Anybody who wants to be a part of it, we'd be honored. If somebody doesn't want to be a part of it, that's also fine, but at least to give it consideration.
That sounds terrific, Amos. I'll also put that link, any links actually that you provide me in my newsletter.
Thank you, my friend.
And we'll give it a chance to circulate out there and see who responds. Well, thank you very much for being on.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
It's been a real treat. That wraps up this episode of the Cybertraps podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, and the challenges of high-tech parenting. Along the way, we'll talk to a growing collection of obviously international experts like Amos, who are here helping us to understand the risks and rewards of digital technology. You can find the Cybertraps podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps. We hope that you'll share the show with your friends and colleagues and reach out to us if you have any questions or topic suggestions. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can reach Jethro Jones at Jethro Jones, and you can reach me at Cybertraps. If you're still listening, you must have enjoyed the podcast. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review in your favorite podcast service. We appreciate having you as a part of our audience and look forward to having you join us on our next episode.
Edited by Gage Sanderson.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students? reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.